I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The acclaimed author Alexander Maksik has just published his second book, A Marker to Measure Drift, published by Bond Street Books, an imprint of Random House. The reviews for this major work of fiction note the author's powerful images and his detailed and haunting evocations of poverty, the horrors of war, isolation, madness, and journey. In the book, we track Jacqueline's journey. We're introduced to her as she scrounges about a Greek island, poor and hungry. We find out more about this woman's past, her connection to Liberia, and the horrific conflict that forces her exile. I'll get Mr. Maksik to tell us about this book as well. We'll reflect on his writing and more. His previous book, You Deserve Nothing, received great notices, and like this new book, a lot of terrific praise from fellow writers. Alexander Maksik is a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and his writing has appeared in sundry publications such as Harper's and the New York Times Magazine, among many others. His website is at alexandermaksik.com. I speak to Alexander Maksik in mid-August from Toronto. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Alexander Maksik. Mr. Maksik, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So when this will be up on the website, it'll be in September. So will you still be on tour for this book?
I will be, yes.
Yeah. And do you enjoy the travel?
I do. I mean, I enjoy talking to readers, and I love going to bookstores. You know, the different cities every day is, can be a bit grueling, but, you know, I honestly have nothing to complain about. It's a rare luxury.
And so are you traveling alone?
I am, yeah. I mean, while I'm in Toronto, I have somebody from Random House who's taking me about, but usually I'm on my own, yeah.
And so that's one of the things in this book is the solitude, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you've traveled, you have traveled a great deal in your life thus far.
Yeah.
Was a lot of that done alone?
It was. I mean, certainly not all of it, but I have traveled a great deal by myself, and I've moved to, you know, to different countries on my own. So there's no question that I have an interest in that kind of travel and that kind of life and both the problems and pleasures that it provides.
When you're described as you have been as one of the most exciting new talents on the literary landscape, what's that like to hear?
Oh, I think it's an exaggeration. I try not to take any of that too seriously. I mean, of course, it's gratifying when people I respect, particularly writers I respect, say nice things about my work. But it seems like, you know, every 15 minutes somebody else is the new next thing. And I know a lot of writers, and I've seen what that can do to people. So I try to just focus on the work.
And does it confer some sort of pressure on you as you write?
No. It really doesn't. I mean, the pressure I feel primarily is upon publication, because there's such a narrow window in which you have to sort of make an impact, and if you don't, or for whatever reason, the reviews don't come. You know, I've seen such wonderful books vanish for no reason other than it seems to me that they just didn't get the attention they deserved. I try, you know. I guess to answer your question, you know, the pressure is not in the writing, or the unpleasant pressure is not in the writing.
Where is the pressure then for you? Is it in the editing?
I mean, again, it's you know, the unpleasant part of it is in the publishing.
I see.
You know, it's wonderful to publish. It's wonderful to see your book in bookstores, and it's a, you know, it's the realization of a long held dream for sure, but it's frightening, I think, in part because it has nothing to do with the work you do, really. I mean, you know, I can't control the way the book is received. I can't control really the way the book is published, even. And I think writers in general are a bit obsessive when it comes to control. And I think it's part of the reason writers write, is to control the world. And so to release a book and out into the universe, it's scary in part because you can't control
it. I noticed when I went to your website that the cover of the book in America is different than the copy that's sitting in front of me that we have here in Canada.
Yeah.
Do you have a say in that?
I did, yeah. In both cases, I had not, you know, contractual approval, but my editors, in so far in each country where the book has been or will be published, I've been asked, you know, to approve the covers, and I'm happy with all of them so far.
And why is there a different one in this country as opposed to that in the United States?
The one that's being used in Canada was actually created more or less in the UK. There's some minor differences, and I think the attitude is it's a brighter cover. It's perhaps more commercially appealing. It's more appropriate for the given market. But again, I don't know, and there's a mystery there that I don't entirely understand.
When I started reading the book. It's odd for me to say this, but I got the cover right away, or the cover sort of evoked what I was reading in the first part of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw the cover for the American version, and I thought, this must be for a different book or something like that, you know?
Yeah, I rather like the American cover, actually.
Really?
I like it very much. I think it's. I mean, I like them both. And I think in their ways they both capture, you know, the sort of the feeling of the book.
Yeah, and so the feeling of the book and where the book begins. One review of the book, I think it was the Boston Globe, made a point that we shouldn't look to the writer's motives or what's real in a work of fiction. You've been asked countless times about the genesis of your first book.
Yep.
And I can sort of see the connection to what happened in your life and the first book. Mm-hmm. This, though, and Jacqueline in A Marker to Measure Drift seems totally foreign to who you are.
I think that it's true, you know, in the most literal sense. But on the other hand, there are themes that I return to over and over again. I think, you know, I mean, it is a book about what it means to be alone and the way that you know, we respond to memory and the importance of memory and the way that we communicate with, you know, with the dead or people who are simply no longer present in our lives. And you certainly, I have never been an African woman, and I've lived a life far more privileged than my protagonist. But the strange thing is that this novel feels to me far more intimate than my first.
How do you get into that headspace, though, of Jacqueline? Because
sure.
when we meet her in the book, and I guess this is what I'm wondering the most is what is she feeling, and how do you get there?
You mean at the start of the novel?
Yeah.
I think at the start of the novel, she is utterly numb, and is trying to focus all of her energy on surviving in a very practical sense. And I think she's trying to avoid communication with her mother, with her family, with memory at all. And I think, you know, as she says, she's trying to maintain a present need, because in that present need is the ability to avoid that which is just sort of more painful than simple hunger or cold or whatever it is that she's trying to avoid in her present life.
And so how do you get into that area? I mean, is that something that you've experienced, or is that something? I mean, did this one have to do research?
I mean, it's. I guess the simplest answer is some combination of imagination and experience. I would never want, you know, to compare myself to Jacqueline or to people who, you know, who have lived or have had to live in the way that she has to live at the beginning of this novel. But you know, the sort of my ambition as a fiction writer, particularly as I continue to write more and more, is to try to imagine the lives of people who are far away from my experience and who've, you know, come from worlds other than my own and have had both you know, problems and advantages that I've never had in my life. That seems to me, anyway, the only way to continue writing. I mean, I don't want to keep writing the same stories over and over again. And that's something I've come to understand in the last few years. So I guess it's just it's a question of imagination, and that's how we measure fiction writers.
I've read some reviews, and as I've mentioned, and one of the words I think that's already been used and used a couple of times, I think, is mesmerizing, when talking about Jacqueline and how you portray her.
Mm-hmm.
Is she someone that you thought a lot about?
Yes, absolutely.
Like even when you weren't writing about her?
Yes, yeah. I mean, that's a sort of one of the strange aspects of writing this book is that I felt, for lack of a better word, haunted by her, and I fell sort of in love with her. I mean, I don't even know if I should say sort of. I thought about her constantly, and I thought about her in the ways I have thought about people I've loved in my life. And that was an experience that was sort of revelatory to me, both in terms of this novel. It allowed me to focus on her in a way that I had not probably ever been able to do in a fictional character, but also more generally in terms of writing fiction, the notion that, you know, that a writer can fall in love with, you know, with creation. I think that's thrilling. And I hope that every book I ever write, I'll have a relationship like that with my protagonist.
And so what's it like then, now that the book's been published, to leave someone like that?
It's difficult, and it's funny because I feel sort of as if I'm moving further and further away from her and therefore from the book. But she's still very present in my mind, and I care about her, maybe in a way that I don't even care about the novel. I mean, I think, you know, once a book is published, you've lost control of it, and it drifts away from you. And yet, I feel quite connected to her, and I still think of her, and I still, you know, it isn't difficult for me to imagine the rest of her life. But you know, that said, I don't think I would write a sequel or a continuation of this book.
Now, I'm assuming you're one of those writers who writes a book and in the midst of writing a book, doesn't really think about the reception that the book will get or who might read the book, or if there's a particular reader in mind that you're catering to.
But now, I mean, I don't consciously think of a particular reader. I mean, I hope for someone who is interested in language and interested in character more than she's interested in plot, because I don't plot is secondary in my work, or at least it feels that way to me, and I certainly don't think of markets, and if I did, I would be writing much different work.
You're right, zombies and things like that.
And occasionally when this becomes, particularly difficult, you start to think, well, maybe I should be writing about zombies or sadomasochism or some combination of the two.
But now that the book's been published, do you have someone in mind as to who should get to know Jacqueline and perhaps the way that you got to know her?
I mean, I'm not particular. I hope people from all walks of life will read the book and come to know her, and I hope love her in the way that I do. I'm very democratic in my hopes for an audience, and I think the subject matter, if not the book itself, but the subject matter is an important one, and the more people who are interested in the lives of the people who are sleeping on the streets or on the beaches of around the world, the better, I would think.
What the book does, though, it inevitably shines a light on this part of the world, on Liberia,
mm-hmm.
and the conflicts there. Mm-hmm. That's something that's not at the top of the newscasts that we watch or in the papers that we read.
No.
Did you set out to want to tell us about this place and what's going on there?
No, I mean, I again, I have no real agenda or message. And, you know, I suppose it's a political novel, but there's no argument being made in the book. I think, you know, certainly if anything, I'm more interested in, you know, sort of shining a light on like I say, on the people you see who are, you know, undocumented laborers, who are living unsheltered in any number of countries. I mean, having spent as much time as I have in Europe and traveling as much as I did, I couldn't personally help but see those people, and I talked to a lot of people who had just arrived in Europe, and I knew their stories a little bit, and those stories seemed crucial to me. And, you know, even if you have no sympathy for those lives, I think from a kind of political standpoint, it's an issue that is pressing on certainly Western Europe, and I think pretty much all over the world.
I guess it's not a big deal anymore that a male writer writes in a female voice.
I hope not.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, I think it's probably a big deal for some people. And, you know, there's the element of race as well that
yeah.
makes it compounds perhaps that what some people would describe as problematic.
But you haven't had notices that have brought that up, have you?
I haven't read any reviews that deal with that. No.
No.
I mean, I feel very strongly a novel or whatever work of art should be evaluated in a vacuum to the extent that that's possible. I've never been interested in the creators of the work as much as I've been interested in the work itself. I'd be hard pressed to find, you know, work that I love that also happens to be, you know, written by people I approve of in all ways. So,
did you grow up in Ketchum?
I grew up from the time I was 14. I moved to Ketchum and lived there 14 until I graduated from high school. And my parents still live there.
Where were you born?
In Los Angeles.
I was looking up Ketchum actually a couple mm-hmm. weeks ago because I live in Vancouver, so mm-hmm. the Idaho I guess is the second closest state. Uh-huh. Other than Washington,
right,
and
sure.
I've been on an obsession and looking for used bookstores throughout the Pacific Northwest, and
uh-huh.
and I was reading a book, and they mentioned the shop in Ketchum. I forget what it's called now.
Iconoclast.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
And it's saying that it's one of these places that you have to visit.
It's a great, great bookstore.
Yeah, and so, I mean, what's that, what's Ketchum like to grow up in?
It's a strange place. I mean, it's you know, it's very wealthy generally, and very white. Less and less so, but yeah, it's a very wealthy and white little ski town. It was a kind of a gift. You know, my parents were both teachers and later administrators. And they moved us out of Los Angeles right at a time when I was in pretty dire need of being moved. And it was a kind of, everything was sort of shifted outdoors. It was a safe light late in the summers, and, you know, I was mountain biking and skiing and doing all of these things that I would never have done in Los Angeles. And yeah, it was a great privilege to grow up there.
See, I've been thinking now of going there because of the bookstore, and also because that's where Hemingway's buried, right?
That's right, yeah. It's where he's buried, where he killed himself. There's a wonderful memorial to him there as well, and you can still visit his house. It's if you're a fan of Hemingway, it's definitely an important place to visit.
See, I don't drive, so what I was wondering about the most was how to get to it. And I think you were just there, weren't you?
Yes, I was. Yeah, I spent quite a bit of time there still because that's, you know, that's where my family is. I mean, you know, you can fly into Haley, and then if you don't drive, you can take a shuttle into town, and it's pretty easy to get around even in the winter.
And I guess you'd fly in from Seattle, or?
You can fly in from Salt Lake.
I see.
And fly in from in the during the sort of high tourist seasons, you can fly in from directly from Los Angeles as well. But the main hub is Salt Lake City.
Now, back to the book. Appreciate the digression here. I'd read somewhere that it was a short story in a magazine, and it was called The Barbarians. And I'd also read an interview that you gave publicizing the last book, saying that The Barbarians was to be the title of this book. When did it change to A Marker to Measure Drift?
That's a good question. I don't remember exactly. I mean, I had published it as an excerpt in Narrative Magazine. And I was writing an essay, and actually my thesis for my thesis, my sort of critical thesis, the critical element of my thesis for Iowa, and in that essay, which was about sensualism, I wrote that sentence. I was describing something and described it as a marker to measure drift, and I just loved the sound of it.
Yeah.
And you know, cut that sentence and put it on my wall, and the more I worked on this novel, the more it seemed to fit.
It's such a beautiful title.
Thank you.
And in reading the book, it makes, you know, it almost explains the book.
Mm. I'm glad to hear you say that, because it was a bit of a struggle to keep that title.
Yeah, and I mean, the Barbarians, it sort of makes sense, but it doesn't really, you know, it doesn't seem clever to me. I don't know.
No, nor I.
Yeah. What is your day like in terms of when you are working on a book like this? Are you one of those writers where you have to have, say, a block of time, like 8 to 9 to 5 or whatever?
Yeah, I'm pretty, when I'm really writing, I mean, right now it's just impossible for me to write, because I'm just constantly moving from place to place. But when I'm happiest, which is when I'm writing, I write, you know, I wake up, I go for a run, and then we'll try to write 1,000 words a day. And that usually means from, you know, 9 or 10 until, when you know, 1 o'clock in the afternoon or so. And when I have a rhythm going, that's pretty attainable, and I can do that for about a month before I need, you know, to take a week off, and then I'll go back and keep going.
And do you find the process fun?
Sometimes I find it fun. Sometimes I find it really, really difficult and frustrating, and it's all I can do to keep myself in a chair. But I think about reading a lot when I'm writing, the sort of experience of reading. And, you know, that moment when you suddenly or gradually, I guess, stop. You no longer know that you're reading, and you're just lost in the book. And that's what I have always loved about reading. One of the things I've always loved about reading, and that's what I aspire to as a writer, you know, where I stop thinking that I'm writing. And I'm just lost in a moment, and I'm just typing, and I'm not aware of myself, and that's the dream. When that happens, that's when I'm happiest, and that's when it's really fun. When you sort of stop and you think, well, you know, how did I just write all of those words?
And how long is it while you're writing before another pair of eyes sees it?
I read a lot of my work to a few friends, I mean, aloud. But it takes me longer, you know. It takes me, I don't know, 50 or 60 pages of pretty clean, or what I think is clean work, before I'll actually show it to anyone.
Huh. And what do you get from reading it aloud?
Music, I hope. It's very helpful for me, in terms of the rhythms of the sentences, to read it aloud. I know exactly how I want it to sound, but it's not until I can read it out loud, you know, it's not obvious to me until I can read it and then I hear it. And sometimes I'll record it, and because I think of it as close to, you know, music as I can come. I can't sing. I can, you know, barely play the guitar, but I feel like when I'm writing, there is a very strong musical element to it. Right? I'd like there to be.
It's fascinating to hear that, because I don't think I've ever talked to a writer who's used, say, the ear for the writing, for what the eye sees.
Yeah, it feels so important to me to hear it.
Yeah. The next book, I understand that's a collection of short fiction. Is that right?
I am about finished with a collection of short fiction, and I'm also working on a novel, which is due in a few years. That's really early still, so I don't have much to say about that one.
Yeah. Well, I'm enjoying this book, and it's been a great pleasure to talk to you today. Good luck with the book.
Oh, thanks so much. I appreciate the time.
The website for more, alexandermaksik.com. The book is called A Measure to Measured Drift. It's from Bond Street Books, which is an imprint of Random House. It was in mid-August when Alexander Maksik joined me on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plata.